This episode of the CMO Suite is brought to you by Ukinex. Ukinex provides digital solutions and teams to brand CMOs, VPs, and marketers looking for true transparency in the biddable media space. From paid social and PPC to complex platforms like the Trade Desk, brands from across the world have connected to Ukinex. Visit them today at ukinex.com. And No Kid Hungry. We're proud to promote No Kid Hungry and their many initiatives to help kids in need of meals. No Kid Hungry helps kids be kids, not be hungry. Visit them at nokidhungry.org. And finally, we're proud that Season 3 of the CMO Suite is presented by the CMOCouncil.org as their official marketers podcast. The Chief Marketing Officer Council is the only global network of executives specifically dedicated to high-level knowledge exchange, thought leadership, and personal relationship building among senior corporate marketing leaders and brand decision makers. The CMO Council's 15,000-plus members control more than $550 billion in aggregated annual marketing expenditures and run complex distributed marketing and sales operations worldwide. For more information on membership, visit thecmocouncil.org. Let's start the show.
You're in the CMO Suite, the podcast for marketers who want to be in the know, presented by Connectivity Holdings.
You are listening to the CMO Suite. I'm your host, Sean Halter. As a reminder, the CMO Suite is brought to you by Connectivity Holdings. It is LA week for us. We come out here at least once a season. I am incredibly excited about my next guest, who we were supposed to actually catch last year. We're going to talk about that just a little bit here shortly, but it's Emmanuel Probst. Emmanuel is the SVP of Brand Health Tracking at Ipsos. He's also the author of Brand Hacks, and he's an adjunct professor at UCLA. How did I do, Emmanuel?
Thank you so much for the great introduction, Sean.
Did I squeeze it all in?
No, you did really well. Yeah.
You've got a lot going on out there. You've got writing out there, you're a professor, and you're the SVP of Brand Health Tracking at Ipsos. So did I pronounce that right?
Yeah, you got it.
Mm-hmm. And I can tell by your accent, you're originally from Brooklyn or not even remotely close.
Actually from Dallas, Texas.
From Dallas, Texas.
Yeah, but everyone thinks I'm from Brooklyn. So that's a fair comment. Yeah.
Where did you grow up, Emmanuel?
I grew up in France.
What part?
Southwest Paris. Then I lived in the UK for a few years, moved to the US to live a dream in 2006. So as you cannot tell from my voice, that was, 13 years ago?
Yeah. Yeah. But that's all right. I mean, look, you still have a lot of Paris in you, and that probably is good because it gives you a nice international flavor to bringing something just different to the game to some extent. And I'm sure that was infused in some of the writing and the other things that you've done. So talk about that a little bit. I'll get into the fact that we almost had you on the show last season. We normally, as many people know, we record out of iHeartRadio in New York City, and we were scheduled to be on, and they're kind enough to host us there by all means. But I got a note pretty late in the morning that I was going to get bumped. And I remember I had to reach out to you and go, oh, my God, I'm so sorry. I'm getting bumped. I'm not sure for who. And then Bob Pittman comes walking up the steps. So that's when you know that you're outranked, clearly outranked. But Bob was very kind, and we are hoping that we get him on the show next season. And I think you said you actually met him. You were at an event, and maybe you saw him as well.
Indeed. It was at CES 2018, January 2018. And I have to say, thanks to iHeart for such an amazing party. iHeart had privatized Dre's, the nightclub, and Marshmello was mixing. But Pittman was there, and I have a few pictures.
You had a good time. You got a few good pictures that we can use along the way if we ever
need to.
That's right, if we ever need to. That's funny. So, yeah, look, that is one of the things that iHeart does a great job. I mean, obviously, this is all about branding, right? It's all about marketing. At the same time, you can use all the data in the world you want, but there is still a beauty in some hand-to-hand combat, whatever that is, getting a chance to kind of meet somebody one-on-one or have people be immersed in your brand to understand what you're all about. And iHeart's certainly one of the best when it comes to that. So you grew up just outside of Paris,
mm-hmm.
Brothers and sisters?
No.
Only child?
Yeah.
Wow. And what did your parents do?
Oh, they work in administration, nothing too exciting.
Okay.
Although one could argue, is market research exciting? But I believe it is.
Yeah.
We can jump ahead to why do I do what I do? And I think what's interesting in market research, what I've been doing through my whole life and what I do in my teaching at Ipsos and my writing, is understand why do people do what they do and ask them those questions. That's the first part. The second part is how can I communicate that knowledge? How can I share that knowledge with readers, with students, and with hosts and listeners to this podcast today?
Yeah. And so from a marketing standpoint, again, it sounds like your background certainly played some role in that trajectory for you, your time that you spent up through there. Did you start in marketing at all when you were still in France, or how old were you when you moved from there?
I was 21.
Okay.
Yeah. 21, and I worked in, I ended up in market research, if you will, by accident. I needed a job when I was doing my MBA in the UK. I needed a part-time job, and a market research agency hired me part-time. So that's how I started in that industry, and I never left.
Was that what you thought you would do when you went to school in the UK? What did you go? What did you go to school for originally? Went to school to go to school.
No, you're right. So what sounds arguably more glamorous is media planning, creative advertising.
Might sound glamorous, not always.
Right, exactly. It might sound glamorous, it not always is. Or most of my classmates will do finance because at the time, I mean, things are changing, but in London, it was a very, very strong place for finance and those are the high-paying jobs. But for the life of me, you know, I cannot move numbers all day long, plus I'm not very good at it anyway.
Yes, not all of us are, which is thank goodness, because the fact that you're not always good at numbers means that you're probably perhaps maybe lean a little more on the creative side to some extent, or at least an opportunity to do something different than just crunch a bunch of numbers. I'm no good at numbers either. So you end up in England and you kind of fall into the space.
Indeed.
And when you fell into that space to some extent, then it was falling into that space that helped you create a passion or at least an understanding of market research?
Exactly. That's what's fulfilling about market research is this constant discovery. It's never-ending process of, again, trying to understand the world around us. Why do people do what they do? From there, how do we build strong brands, strong products that are meaningful to people, not just something else on your shelf?
We spend a lot of time on this show with marketers and VPs, and digital obviously comes up consistently. It's not going away. It gives them some opportunity to be able to immerse themselves in at least what they think consumers are trying to tell them. But market research, I'm sure, also helps them really understand what consumers are trying to tell them just beyond some spots and some dots. So when you ended up in market research over there, eventually you moved here to the States. And I apologize, where did you say you first moved to?
Chicago.
Okay. So you lived in Chicago for just a bit. I used to live in Hoffman Estates. What part of Chicago did you live in?
Lincoln Park.
Oh, that's beautiful there.
And very so nice indeed.
Did you move there for a job specifically?
Yeah, I was already with Research Now at the time, so they moved me from London to Chicago. They were expanding on the U.S. market. Those were great years, 2006, 2007, 8, 9, 10.
It feels like that was a long time ago, but at the same time, it wasn't that long ago either, you know? Mm-hmm. Had you ever experienced snow like
that? Oh, boy.
That?
In fact, I was on a call this morning with my HR partner, and he's based in Chicago. And it's 20 degrees there. And I'm like, have at it.
That's fall.
Know? Yeah.
20 degrees. That's fall in Chicago. My dad used to live there. I'd go and visit him. Thank goodness I mostly visited him in the summertime. So how was that? Obviously, London is a very big metropolis to some extent. So it's a very forward-thinking city. Mm. Was it overwhelming to end up in Chicago? Or did it just feel like London but a lot colder and with stranger people?
So it's very different. London and Chicago are very different, and here's why. London is a very international type of place, a hub by European standards, if you will. Chicago is a big city in the Midwest, so it's the place to go, I feel, where you grew up in Indianapolis and Minneapolis and Cincy and Lexington, and so it's really this big city in the Midwest, but it's
part of its charm, right?
It is indeed. Agreed.
It's not New York. It's not the craziness of, oh my God, I'm in New York. It's not Los Angeles, which is the craziness of this thing is so big and so wide and spread out. But it does give you a midpoint to some extent.
It really does. Now, from a cultural standpoint.
Very Midwestern values.
Very Midwestern, very welcoming. And in business also, very CPG. I mean, it sounds like it goes without saying, but a lot of red brick type of industries, I feel. So, of course, we have the likes of Sara Lee and Conagra and very traditional businesses, if you will, United, Boeing, and of course in the Midwest, General Mills, Procter & Gamble, Nestle, in contrast with New York, which as we both know is a very, very strong place for media, and Los Angeles Entertainment and San Francisco for tech. So what's interesting is different cultures, different type of people, but also very, very different business culture, whereby on the West Coast, we have a much stronger culture of data science and activation. In the Midwest, much more of a culture of traditional knowledge around market research.
And it is funny to take kind of just those three cities, literally three cities out of hundreds of cities in the U.S. I have no idea how many actual cities there are. My son would know because he knows everything about cities. But you take just those three cities, and as you know, as you just spoke to, they kind of all have a personality to them. And in doing so, it kind of creates this three-legged stool to some extent, which is really what, you know, what all of the rest of marketing seems to kind of build off of in some ways.
And indeed, in market research, when we do test markets, since you cannot go to 100, 150 markets, you'll pick test markets, and you'll most of the time end up picking New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, San Francisco. Then you'll pick one in the South, Dallas or Houston, and then you'll pick somewhere more remote, if you will, that is supposed to be more rural America. But you said it, those four, five, six cities we discussed here, they give you a good enough contrast of the population.
And so talk about market research. Obviously, that's what your background is in. The title itself, you know, was interesting to us. As I often say on this show, we try to make sure each season we have a great mix of CMOs and VPs who talk about their life path and how they ended up where they are. We were lucky enough to interview Eduardo Luz last year in Chicago. Speaking of Chicago, he was at Kraft Heinz just before his departure to move to New York and become the CEO of 8 Greens. And so it is funny. I think he's originally Argentinian, but no matter where you come from when you live in Chicago, you end up with that little bit of just a Chicago accent when you actually say Chicago. So so that said, you end up in the space. And so talk about the fact that, again, it is immersive across all of these trajectories and paths. And no matter what your title is, market research is to some extent kind of the basis of what you're hopefully trying to build your strategies around, I would assume, to some extent.
It is indeed. For the longest time, market research was in a silo. I think it was those nerdy guys crunching numbers, if you will. And that's changing, one, because as you said, it permeates across organizations. And two, because market research is no longer about assessing your performance in the past, but it's also about predicting the future and help the marketing team activate. Most of the work I do with my clients right now is about building predictive tools and also about making sense of disparate sets of data. Twitter feeds and Facebook and Instagram, what does that mean to my brand? And how can I use this signal combined with survey, with purchase data? How can I use this signal to predict how people will feel about my brand in the future and to predict sales?
Do you feel like some of the larger organizations have that structure built into them already? They have already large market research teams, and then maybe those who have to be a little bit more lean out there are kind of more leaning on people like you or your organization to be able to provide them as much of that same level of service as possible.
And that's where the contrast between the Midwest and the West Coast is interesting. So to address your question, if you go to organizations like Nestle, General Mills, Procter & Gamble, Kimberly-Clark, the short answer is no, meaning those folks have built-in market research teams, but not a strong culture of what to do with the research, not a strong culture around predicting data science activation and all that. On the West Coast, when you talk with technology clients, think of Google, Visa, Amazon, of course, advanced technology clients, you have a very strong culture of data science, meaning a culture of modeling things out, of predicting, of activating. That is, I'm gathering knowledge. Okay, that's good. But what is that going to enable me to do? So in short, very different cultures, West Coast around data science, making sense of data, activating. In the Midwest, much more of a deep understanding of how can I measure my performance.
And maybe, again, that's just baked into the kind of technologies and the kind of companies that are there, and the fact that the West Coast does tend to be a little bit more immersive in that side of the space. So as you made your way through there, where are you living now? Are you living here?
I live in Los Angeles.
So you're mm-hmm. living in Los Angeles.
Most of the time.
Some of your time out on the East Coast a little bit as well here and there, or it just depends?
Yeah, about once every 3 months, New York, Chicago once every 3 months, and then San Francisco all the time, and Seattle, like, I don't know, every month.
And you wrote a book as well?
Mm-hmm.
So talk to us about that. A lot of people talk about writing a book, or that they want to write a book, or they They feel like that's something that's in them. What was it that inspired you to finally go ahead and do it?
Yeah, so, you know, I do market research the whole day for a living. And on Thursday nights for fun, I teach market research at UCLA. And then when I go home, as a hobby, I write about market research, right?
So let's. Do you have anything that's not market research related in your life to some extent?
No, I like reading books about market research, or I listen to podcasts a lot.
Oh, good. Yeah. You should listen to this one. We talk about stuff, but not as much market research, which is why you're on here, because we need to find out more about it. So you live it. Yeah, that's for sure.
Yeah, so I'm happy to address your question more seriously, and I think that will be really valuable to our listeners. So in marketing, in market research, we spend most of our days pushing advertising products and brands down the throat of consumers. You mentioned digital earlier. That's a big shortcoming of digital. Don't get me wrong. It's powerful. It's great for targeting. But we spend most of our days thinking, how can I sell more and how can I sell faster? And that's fine. But I thought there was another way to look at the world. That was to say, let's take a pause here. Understand that most consumers don't care about most brands. People don't want any more products. People don't want any more advertising. Why? Because we burn them out, because we advertise too much, because we blast. So we start from that grim assumption that people don't like products.
The grim assumption, yes. That most of our jobs that are related to advertising, people don't want.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I've seen that. I've seen how many media plans of brands spending $5 million of every week and getting nothing in return. So knowing that people cannot stand advertising anymore, let's take a step back and understand, why do people want to achieve? Well, people want to find meaning. People want to do things that are meaningful, purposeful, experience a sense of fulfillment. From there, if we understand meaning, if we understand how people find meaning, we can build brands that contribute to fulfilling this quest for meaning. So that's the point for the book. The concise explanation is, most marketing books look at how to push more ads and products down the throat of consumers. In contrast, Brand Hacks is about understand how people find meaning and build brands that help fulfill this quest for meaning.
And how long ago did you write Brand Hacks? Is it new?
It came out May 14th.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so from there, again, it sounds like, and correct me if I'm wrong, that one of the main pieces of the book is to help maybe brands to create a passion even to some extent.
Yeah. The point of the book is to help brands create products and brands, by the way, that are stronger, more sustainable, that people will feel more loyal to, that also can command a premium. Again, a brand that is meaningful, that is purposeful, is more likely to command a premium. And it's to do this whether you're a very big brand like iHeartMedia or if you're the small guys.
And do you feel like that doesn't happen enough just simply because we get buried in the minutia of the day and pushing stuff out, and at the end of the day, you still need a media plan, and so let's hurry up and get that out there.
Yeah.
And is it lacking more in the creative process and the content development process itself? Is that really where that needs to start? Because you can buy all the billboards in the world, but if the message doesn't convey a passion for the product, then the media plan is almost worthless to some extent.
Yeah, that's fair. So that's the classic, right, between creative and media planning on why is it not working? Well, because the media planning agency is not doing a good job, or no, it's because the creative sucks. So I think the answer is, the urgency we feel today is on both sides, because creative agency are getting a lot of pressure to get the creative executions out faster. And that pressure comes from, you know, quarterly earning calls and this false assumption that digital is going to tell you everything instantaneously and perform like overnight, which is not exactly true. So
how do you break that cycle, though? Because it is the cycle. It seems to come from the C level down. A CEO who doesn't really understand how it works, but has just enough knowledge perhaps to be dangerous enough to say, well, what did the data tell us on Tuesday? So let's change everything on Wednesday.
Yeah. Well, you look at a brand like Kraft Heinz.
Which is where Eduardo was for a while. Yep.
Yeah. Which no later than what, yesterday or the day before, announced that they will invest in the brand again, invest in innovation again, prioritize some strategic initiatives, because that lower funnel performance marketing obsession did not get them anywhere. I mean, they're down double digits on all their key products.
Sure.
And it's going downhill. You look at brands that Adidas is another one. Adidas said, it was about 2 years ago now, 2.5 years ago, well, we're going to invest 100% of our media dollars on digital because we can measure performance and those click-throughs and all that. Well, guess what? Last week or the week before, over the last few days, they said, well, you know, that wasn't a good strategy. Maybe we should think about offline and a more traditional approach to a media plan. So back to your question, of course, you have to feed the C-suite with something. And you can, don't get me wrong, those instant metrics on click-throughs and CPAs and whatnot, they're still valuable, but it's important to show that this is not the whole story. And building a brand is a 9 to 18 months endeavor, not a 9 minutes type of plan.
And that's what you're finding out there a little bit. But again, perhaps to your point, it's coming back around.
Yeah.
Those that feel like you can develop a brand in the matter of a couple months are those that are always going to be disappointed because it's just not the reality. It doesn't matter how much data you have. You know, we had that conversation with a consumer brand not too long ago that it just, consumers are still consumers. You can use all the data that you want in the world and utilize digital to the best extent, but consumer behavior hasn't changed that much so that you can instantaneously change their mindset if they've never seen your brand before. So maybe there is a way for that to kind of circle around. How is the teaching going? Talk to us about that. How did you end up out at UCLA?
Well, I applied for the job. That it's as simple as this. So the teaching is very fulfilling because students challenge me, if you will. The questions that come up are always interesting. They're, you know, 23 to 29, 23 to 30 age brackets, and it's pretty no filter, pretty much.
Straight up.
Yeah, straight up. So what's interesting about this, what's most rewarding about the teaching is people come to my class because they have to. 9 times out of 10, it's not because they want to. And the challenge for me is to transform this mindset of, oh boy, I'm here because I have no choice, into someone telling me after 12 weeks, this was the best class ever. So that's the goal, to communicate that passion for market research. And again, to show people why it matters and how we can activate that knowledge as opposed to just read textbooks.
That's got to be pretty fulfilling.
Indeed. Yeah.
Talk about yourself just for a few more moments. Who is somebody whose advice has helped you in this space? Clearly, you love the space. You've spent most of your life, working life, in the space. But there must be days where you sometimes are ready to pound your head on the table and just say, I'm ready to do something completely different. So whose advice, as you just spoke about being a teacher and kind of instilling that, you know, the advice in students to the point where they feel like they're actually glad they had to take this class, who's helped you along the way?
Right. I'm thinking of, there's a quote I really like from Philip Kotler. He wrote 17 or 18 marketing books, and I just came across that quote from him a few days ago, but he says, I enjoy, so why do you keep writing books? That was the question, right? Because I think he's 92 or anyway. And he says, because I enjoy producing more than consuming. And that really resonates with me. So this always be curious type of mindset, I think is inspiring. What I like about market research is the humility that comes with this industry. It is not, unlike, I will say that, advertising sometimes, it is not that know-it-all, ego-driven, at times misogynistic industry. And advertising is changing a lot. But when I started 15, 20 years ago...
That's what it was.
That's what it was.
The Mad Men parts.
Yeah, totally. You know,
that was still living there.
Very much so. Especially, I mean, in the UK as well.
Sure.
Yeah.
But that's changing now, certainly to some extent, and to your point. So... got a few more minutes. Again, Emmanuel Probst. The book is called Brand Hacks, correct? Did I get that right?
Mm-hmm.
It's available on Amazon, mm-hmm. I'm assuming.
You got it.
And other places, I'm sure. All you got to do is just go to Google. They probably already know that you're looking for the book when you go to Google now, and they'll just kick it your direction. They'll hear that you're listening to this podcast, and they'll push an ad your way. That's how crazy virtual reality seems. I could spend an hour talking about how crazy that is. You're talking about something with a friend and then you get an ad pushed to you the next day. It's crazy and scary at the same time. That said, what do you feel like is next? what do you feel like is either next for you, or what do you feel like is next in this space when it comes to consumer research?
What's next is the ability to predict. What's next is gathering disparate sets of intelligence, of data, combining this to make sense of it. So here's the deal. All the brands that have tried to make sense of numbers only, what is trendy to call big data, they all fail because, once again, you can decide on what you're going to do the next day, but you're not building a brand here. The art is to combine the data and the insights. So what's next is to say, well, big data is very valuable, but not in isolation. Survey data is valuable, but not in isolation. And consumer insights, ethnography, all that, that's very valuable, not in isolation. The strength, because all those methodologies and silos have weaknesses. And data scientists on the West Coast, they think they know best, but they don't. Look at Blue Apron, for example. Retention rates are very, very bad. They bleed 70% members a year because data science has nothing to do with human marketing. Right. So what's next is exactly this, is to say, I'm going to leverage some data from search. I'm going to leverage some data from Instagram. What type of colors do I see in Instagram pictures, for example? I'm going to leverage some survey data asking people how they feel about a brand, about a product, about a need. I'm going to leverage some purchase data at store level. And I'm going to combine all this, make sense of that. One, it gives me a fuller picture of who people are, why do they do what they do. Two, most importantly, it's going to enable me to predict what they're going to do next.
It is this predictive modeling that is one of the scariest things to me, but also perhaps the most exciting. You know, just as I said a few moments ago, the fact that Google or Facebook or Instagram kind of knows already what I'm looking before I even really know right. what I'm looking for. It seems right. like, again, that just will continue to build and bend. And brands that are trying to stay at the forefront of that will be those who stay in the forefront of consumers. So listen, Emmanuel Probst, thank you so much. I'm glad we finally made it together and that we got a chance to have you on the show. The book is called Brand Hacks. Again, we want to appreciate you for coming on the show. If you want to find out more about Emmanuel, all you got to do is stalk him on LinkedIn. That's what we do pretty consistently. He's a consistent poster often, or pick up the book. Again, it's called Brand Hacks. And thank you for joining us on the show today.
Thank you for having me, Sean. Terrific.
Thanks.
Thank you again.
Take us out of the show.
Thanks for hanging out in the CMO Suite. The podcast for marketers who want to be in the know. Presented by Connectivity Holdings.
You're a C-level manager. You shouldn't have to know the difference between behavioral or contextual targeting. But your agency should. Uconnects provides brands and biddable teams direct access to platforms like The Trade Desk, Google, Amazon, Facebook, OTT, and more. Their U.S.-based traders can train your in-house team or provide complete transparency with no minimums and CPM-based service pricing for true transparency. Something Mighty Hive, The Trade Desk, and Centro simply don't offer. Tired of being the smartest one in the room? Reach out to Uconnects today for a free demo. Uconnects, the world's leader in true, transparent, biddable media.